Good afternoon. Is this microphone doing reasonably well for those of you up in the back? Good, great, because I can't tell at all from down here whether you can hear it or not. Someone asked me earlier what the more, more, more was all about, and I said, well, when I started thinking about doing another sort of porting-related talk in the context of Debian, I started thinking about all of the architectures and all of the packages and all the fails to build from source bugs, and there's just more of each that come along, and I'll let you figure out which one is lowercase and uppercase and all of that. Out of curiosity, how many of you run Debian on at least one system? You know, that's a higher percentage than we had at DebConf, too. I think they let more students slide. Actually, the next question is, how many of you run it on something other than an i386 architecture? That's really cool. Predominantly, what kind of stuff? He's like, okay. Can I get an ARM? Never mind. Do any of you run it on i64? Oh, that's frightening. Okay. Yes. My humble employer will be happy to sell you some. And actually, as long as I'm mumbling about that, I would like to thank the organizers of the event for inviting me back this year. This is actually the talk that got me invited to come back this year. In other words, you're about to hear the talk I was really invited to Australia to do. And then after that, little things happened, and I guess I'm supposed to talk again tomorrow morning and, you know, do the keynote thing. And earlier this week, I've already given a couple of talks in the Debian Mini Conference. Out of curiosity, how many of you were around for those? Yeah, lots of you as well. Good. There's going to be very little overlap today. There really are so many things going on within Debian space and within porting space and all of that, that this is a more or less completely different set of things I want to talk about. You'll recognize a couple of the slides, but I told you the other day that a couple of the slides about growth in developers and packages I tend to use over and over again, and I guess you'll get to see that that really is true. And those of you who were in Brisbane last year, you'll recognize a slide or two out of this set because during the Debian Mini Conference last year, I did a little talk about porting things, and some of the issues that I talked about there are still relevant. What I'd really like to do today, if nothing else, is convince you of this first point, and that is that solving portability problems really improves software quality. Almost everything that we run into when we have trouble porting a piece of software across architectures is because of something that wasn't done, that could have been done or should have been done when that software was written or in its early stages of evolution, that would have more completely specified what the behavior was that the author expected. And almost all the porting problems you run into are where people have made assumptions or they've relied on default behaviors or they've had expectations about what was going to happen. They get trashed when they run into some architecture that works differently than what they normally use. I also want to point out that auto-building is an interesting way to drive portability issues to needing to be resolved. In Debian, we now have an immense number of packages across a really frightening number of architectures, and we keep all of those up to date from a single set of non-architecture specific source packages on a more or less daily basis, and I want to explain a little bit about how that happens. And in the process, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the problems that we've run into, and I'm going to try and end up with a few ideas about how you as software developers or as people trying to use software across multiple architectures and running into problems that you want to report as bugs and so forth, how all of you can help with this process. And again, you know, if nothing else, if you come away from this believing the mantra that improving software portability improves software quality, then I'll feel like it's been a good day. And of course, the obligatory warning, it's a little hard to be Debian project leader and stand up and give a talk like this without having a certain amount of it be from a Debian perspective. Since so many of you seem to think Debian's okay, I won't worry about that too much. For those of you that aren't real gung-ho on Debian. When I talk about lots of big numbers, this is what I'm talking about. In Brisbane last year, it was 6 released architectures. It's now 11. Last year, it was around 800 people, and now it's over 1,100. Last year, it was 4,700 source packages, if I remember correctly, and I think we were in about 6,500 binary packages at that time. So you can see that not only are these numbers big, but they're growing at a relatively alarmingly linear rate. And if you look at the list of architectures across there, be afraid. ARM goes all the way down to things like the compact IPAC handhelds. You know, it's S390s in there. And so this stuff really has, you know, it's being used across environments that scale all the way from things that fit in your pocket to things that don't. There are some other ports in process. I mentioned a couple here. The Hitachi SuperH is sort of interesting. It's an example of a class of architecture where almost every version of the chip that comes out really wants a different set of compiler options. And so trying to do a pre-built set of binaries the way Debian does within Debian's binary architecture structure for a family like that's really frustrating. But came and said, you know, they only wanted 4 new binary architectures, and we sort of laughed. And then the Hammer stuff, I'd really love to see more progress there than we've had so far, but then I guess now at least 2, maybe 3 subgroups within Debian that have gone off and tried to get started on that, and it seems to be the common problem seems to be actually getting your hands on real hardware to do development with right now, but I'm sure that'll change over time. And as if all of this hardware architecture portability stuff wasn't enough, we also insist on being crazy enough to try and work with multiple kernels. There are a couple of different BSD kernel combined with Debian user space projects still going. The one working with OpenBSD kind of stopped. I think that in the end, the objectives they had were driven more by some of the marketing hype around OpenBSD than any really great sense of what they were going to have that was different or better in the end. But the FreeBSD and NetBSD kernel integration activities are still underway. And of course, Debian is the project or the distribution that was chosen by the FSF Herd folks to be the user space for their kernel work. So there's lots of interesting stuff going on. Some of these, particularly the ports to support different kernels, don't get quite as good a reception some days as the architecture ports, but there's just a huge amount of porting activity going on in and around the Debian project. I was talking about how those numbers grow. This line stays pretty linear. That's the number of Debian developers. The way I actually measure this, by the way, is I use Katami's website that shows the number of unique email addresses associated with the maintainer address for source packages. That is inflated slightly over the number of developers that are on the key ring or in the LDAP servers, because of course there's some mailing lists for big packages where there's multiple people maintaining them, like compilers and libraries. There are also a couple of situations I know of where a single maintainer uses different email addresses for each of the packages they maintain. But I would argue that it's a pretty good first order approximation, because for each one of those cases, there's probably 5 or 6 people maintaining packages for Debian who aren't developers yet and are using our sponsorship mechanism to get them uploaded into the archive. So I think that there really are 1,100 and some or more people that are actively working on maintaining the packages that are in Debian. And what you notice that's interesting is, other than that big dip when we closed our new maintainer process for a while and just didn't allow anyone else into the project, the number of registered developers continues to grow at an approximately linear rate. And they're pretty widely geographically distributed. This is a plot from our website that takes all of the developers in the LDAP database who have voluntarily chosen to provide a latitude longitude and sticks them on the map. As you can see, they're pretty broadly distributed. I've discovered, intriguingly enough, in my travels in the last year, that there's some places you'd think there might be Debian developers, but there aren't yet, so I'm trying to fix that. But well, for example, there's not a single registered Debian developer in Mexico, and yet Debian is arguably the most popular distribution in Mexico right now, old versions of Red Hat being possibly more voluminous in terms of total number. But there are 2 guys that are in the queue right now, so maybe that'll change. This is the other sort of frightening plot that I look at with some regularity, because you notice that until this latest data point, which may or may not, you know, smooth itself back out over time, this has actually been a little worse than linear, a little better than linear. I don't know, apply your own value judgments, but it's been growing a little bit faster than linear. This is the count of source packages over time. And this is going back with a modest number of data points to 1996, when there were a few hundred, and now, as I said, there are over 7,000. A couple other things about Debian that are sort of important is context for talking about porting things. Debian has this public bug tracking system that operates mostly email in, web out. It's completely open. Most of you seem to be running Debian one place or another, so this is probably not news to you. It's a really significant and important part of how the porting process is successful in Debian, though. And also, the way packages get integrated into Debian through source packaging according to a set of fairly well-defined, if sometimes contentious, policies means that when we discover some sort of structural problem or, you know, some widespread issue that could be addressed by adding another paragraph to the policy manual, we do that, and we go out and file a bunch of bugs against the packages that don't comply and expect those to get resolved. So there's this sort of relationship between the process of trying to build all these packages and keep them up to date, the policies that describe sort of this bare minimum set of expectations about how people are going to package source code so that it can be built and distributed in our environment, and the bug tracking system, which we use to keep track of sort of all of the open issues and work to do. The bug tracking system is now up to bug number, God, I've lost track, 180,000 or so. So over the course of the Debian project, and that's that number began in about 1994, we've now tracked over 170-some thousand at least bugs reported in the packages. And the number of currently open bugs also seems to be increasing kind of linearly. That bothers some people. I keep saying, well, if it's not growing any more than linearly and the number of packages is growing linearly, maybe it's not so bad. but again, the numbers are sort of staggering if you sit back and try to take them in isolation. We'll see what it all means someday. So when I talk about porting, what do I really mean? Well, when I talk about porting, I'm really thinking in the context of taking a Linux distribution and trying to make it work on a new architecture, because that's what I personally get the most jazzed about. But in my history, I've also done lots of things in the embedded system space. I've done lots of things that weren't specifically related to Linux distributions. But since that's sort of the flavor of the talk for today, let me just suggest that what porting really involves in, you know, in the context of this talk is getting working tool chains, getting working kernels, getting all of the user space applications that people expect to compile and run successfully on a given architecture. And then one of the things that's really intriguing when you port to some new piece of hardware is dealing with the installation problem. Every architecture has a different bootstrapping tool set. They all have different file systems that are, you know, that their firmware understands. Every once in a while somebody says they're going to go, you know, start over from scratch and do it right, and they put DOS and ROM on IS64. It's sort of intriguing to watch this whole progression and all the different approaches people have taken and how poorly most of them work. But what it means is that there is a per-architecture component of figuring out how you're going to get your software installed and get over that initial hurdle. And one of the things that I think Debian takes a lot of flack for is having an installer that's not really cute and glitzy. It seems to me that a lot of people who review Linux distributions principally review the Linux distribution's installation process. I don't know that many of them actually run Linux full-time, or if they do, that they run sort of the same version for long enough to, you know, have very well-formed opinions about things like, you know, what it takes to get security updates and, you know, how you keep a system productive and functional over a long period of time. And a lot of folks within Debian care a whole lot more about that than they do about a glitzy install, because after all, you install once and you upgrade for the rest of your life. So it's sort of interesting how that goes. And yet, the positive side of the Debian installation process is we have an installation toolset that will install on anything. 11 architectures, and if you've ever done a Debian install and survived, you can probably walk over to another machine and do it. I'd like to tell a story of the fact that I was out at the Dayton Amateur Radio Convention in May of, the year before last. And there were some people selling, some Russian guys there selling big piles of Ultra Sparks. And the little spark box I had that I kept around to work on spark porting issues had croaked. Actually, its power supply had died, the infamous IPX power supply death problem. And these guys had really nice, well-equipped Ultra Spark 10s for, you know, a couple hundred dollars. And so I bought one, took it home, burned a copy of the Ultra Spark version of disc one of the Debian CD set, dropped it in, plugged in a monitor and a keyboard, turned the thing on, brought it up, went through the installer, went through the process, got to where I had a base system plus SSH and a couple other things installed, leaned back, looked at it and said, yep, works just like all the others, turned it off and really haven't played with it much since. It's amazingly boring. I mean, they really do all sort of work the same way. If you've played with multiple architectures in Debian, you're well aware of the funky issues that you have to deal with. On some PowerPC laptops are a particularly bad example because they've got all sorts of funkyisms, I gather, though I've never personally played with one. But in so many of the cases, the fact that we make sort of lowest common denominator assumptions about the console hardware and so forth means that things just tend to work. To do this requires a real positive attitude and just lots and lots of iteration. So in Debian, as I've already mentioned, the whole porting process is sort of driven by the packaging system. We have a really granular, really finely grained packaging system with strong build dependencies and runtime dependencies articulated between the packages. The policy documents about how we package things and sort of what the rules are for doing things so that they'll work well have a huge impact on this. The auto builders are very important. And I put IRC on there because, quite frankly, when we start working on a new architecture, it's the middle of the night and you're getting really frustrated, and Brendan happens to be on and knows what that Perl problem is that makes this stuff not so hard to accomplish. Let me talk just briefly about what happens to a Debian package. I keep talking about auto building. What do I mean? Well, in Debian, somebody goes out and makes a source code change, and the package maintainer, maybe the person who did that, or maybe it's an upstream change or they found a patch from somewhere, they go and update the Debian source package and upload it, usually along with one or more binary package builds. We don't actually allow source-only uploads because it would make it way too easy for people to upload source packages that they've never tried to build before, and that's a really bad idea. So typically, someone will upload, for example, if it's me, it's an IA64 binary package and a source package, but for most folks, it's an I386 and a source. Our archive maintenance toolset, which is called Debian Archive Katie, performs a set of basic checks on the package, and after those basic consistency checks have been passed, the package gets put in something called the accepted queue. Once a day, items get picked up out of the accepted queue and put into the archive itself, and the archive is updated. But during the time between the upload and when that happens, these packages are laying around, and the auto builders know how to notice them there and pick them up. So typically within a few minutes after a source package upload has been picked up in the accepted queue, one or more of the auto builders will have noticed it, picked it up, and started building it, particularly on the faster architectures. And once they've run a build, either the build succeeded or it failed, and if it failed or succeeded, there's a log that's generated. That log gets emailed both to the administrator of the auto builder for that architecture and to a system called buildy.debian.org. Buildy.debian.org is basically a database of build logs from all of the auto builders. So if you maintain a package called, gzip, and you upload a new version of gzip, you can go look a little while later at buildy.debian.org, where a little while could be as soon as an hour later, and put in the name of your package, and it will show you the recent build history of, which architectures it succeeded and failed on, and you can click through and actually go read the log produced by the auto builder and so forth. It's a fairly powerful mechanism. It's really particularly helpful when somebody has done something and they say, I know that this builds on these four architectures, And I don't believe that I've broken anything anywhere else, but I'd like to know whether this really works after I upload it. It gives them a way to go look. It also means that when we file a bug report against the package, instead of having to include really hideously huge chunks of build log within the message that we're posting, we'll you know, often include just a tiny little snippet of the log that shows the actual error that was raised that caused the build to fail. And then at the bottom, we'll include a clickable URL thing that'll take you over to the site if you want to go see the whole log. Because I think we all have experienced that case where the thing that actually was the problem was buried up in the noise way earlier in the build process. And then the people who administer these auto builders, folks like me, read these emails and decide what to do with them. In the case of build success, it's really simple. There is a portion of that log that's mailed out that's a changes file that has all of the information required to successfully do an upload of the resulting package. And we use little tools grafted into our mailers to clip that section out, cryptographically sign it, and send it back to the auto builder system. On receipt of one of those, it goes, oh, I can upload that. It grabs up all of the referenced files, does the MD5 sum checks, and if everything matches, it uploads to the archive, and that auto builder's done with that package, that version. If it's a failure, then different things happen. The person who's reading this email will often be the one who goes and does some triage on the package. You can configure our auto building software different ways, but on all of the auto builders where we have enough disk space, we actually leave the build trees for failed builds around long enough to be able to go and take a look and, you know, poke around in that build tree and see what happened. There are a couple of sort of systemic failures that occur once in a while, but they're not frequent enough for us to really get rabid about fixing the code so they don't happen. One of them is that if somebody uploads two versions of a new package in rapid succession, sometimes the auto builder has attempted a build of the first version and has mailed the message off to the buildy administrator. The buildy administrator hasn't read his mail yet and responded to it. New version gets uploaded. A build of that starts in, unfortunately, the same directory tree under the chroot. The administrator reads his mail, responds, and says, oh, that build failed, so just please, you know, throw that away and we'll go file a bug or something. And it trashes the running build instance. This happens, I think, to the average auto builder, it happens maybe once every 2 weeks. And so when you see this, there's sort of a fingerprint that you get when you get a log from one of that class of failed builds, and you sort of just go, oh, crap. And you hit a keystroke or two in your mailer that sends a message back saying, just retry that one. And because we made it so easy to send a retry message, we really haven't been motivated to go fix the underlying problem yet. But we'll get there eventually. So in the end, the successfully built packages get signed and uploaded where the cryptographic signature on them is that of the person who maintains that auto builder. And that's about as close to the right answer as we've been able to come up with. But the more interesting case is failures. What do you do with failures? And it turns out it's just a horribly manual process. It's the thing that consumes huge numbers of hours for people that are working on new architectures, is unraveling and figuring out, oh, this is a problem we have or haven't seen before. And even if we have seen the problem before, how do you recognize another instance of that? And have you gotten savvy enough to go create a set of, you know, file fragments in a directory somewhere so that you can craft a bug report or send off a message to the person who maintains that package without having to sort of sit out and type out, you know, two paragraphs of text. So I keep mentioning these different pieces. This is sort of how things fit together. It's a little idealized. It's, you know, if I tried to show you all of the interactions between all the pieces, it would be impossible to read. What sort of happens here is that packages in the archive, as I said, get uploaded and they're sitting around in queues and all this sort of thing. We have this database called WannaBuild, and it's sort of the list of things that need to get built. And the way it's organized is by architecture, by package, what the state of that package is at the moment. And the state could be needs build, it could be failed, it could be waiting for some build dependency with one or more dependencies listed. Or it could be in state building, which is what often happens while things are really happening. Humans interact with WannaBuild. It's possible for me to go and you know, clean up entries, or someone says, gee, I think this other seemingly unrelated thing has been updated, and now maybe this will build. Would you try it again, please? and you can manually go and poke the build system and tell it to try a build again. This thing called Andrea is sort of deprecated at this point. It was a tool for trying to determine what the build time dependencies were for packages that did not specifically specify what their build time dependencies were. And it would do sort of tricky things like it would say, oh, well, if the installable binary version of the package depends on libfoo, and there happens to be a libfoo something-dev package in the archive, then maybe it would be a good idea to install that before you try to build this package. Fortunately, with the release of Woody, including build time dependencies in the configuration files in the source package is part of policy. And so now we just treat those as bugs when we run into cases where the build dependencies are not completely specified, and we expect them to get fixed. And so Andrea is pretty much gone, except that there are some vestiges of it around, and there are a few special cases it helps us handle. This thing called sbuild is sort of the magic piece. It's the piece that actually does a build of a package. It automatically manages a chroot environment. It knows how to take a minimal chroot environment and populate it. When I say minimal, I mean Debian essential plus build essential, which are the things that your package is supposed to, anything else that you require in order to build is supposed to be explicitly specified. And so sbuild knows how to download and install the packages required to augment that chroot environment, run the build, capturing all the logs and so forth, and in the end, put the chroot back the way it was. That last part doesn't always work right for certain classes of poorly constructed source packages. It's a source of personal frustration to me every time I have to go and dig through and put my chroot back together. Unfortunately, all of the solutions that we've come up with so far for dealing with the let's have the chroot environment be completely pristine every time, until and unless we have a nice working generalized kernel-provided union mount facility, hint, hint, are sort of hideous and slow. And then there's this thing called the build daemon, which actually runs on each of the auto-build systems, and its job is to basically interact with the WannaBuild database running up on one of our central project servers to figure out, for this architecture, what needs to be built next, and invokes sbuild, handing it lists of packages that need to be built. And it's actually that build daemon called build D that those of us who administer these systems mostly interact with. These paths down here, poking with sbuild directly and poking with WannaBuild directly, it's important to have those paths. We don't use them very often in a relative sense. So as I mentioned, when you get email from the build daemon, it's either successful or we can give the package back, which means we'd like you to try this again, basically. There's a not for us. Every once in a while, somebody uploads a package which has some completely reasonable excuse for having an architecture specification that's very general but is never, ever going to possibly work or ever be relevant on this architecture. So it can tag something as not for us. There are other mechanisms for doing that. In particular, there's a file sort of in Andrea space called packages arch specific, or PAS. And that one is where we actually try to code most of the dependencies. Like, there's no point in trying to build PowerPC kernels on IE64 systems and things like that. And then there are a couple of reasons that things can fail that are sort of routine. One of them is failing for a build dependency. If a package specifies a build time dependency on some other package, the dependency mesh in Debian can at times be so complicated that some human involvement is required to figure out which piece that's not current right now is really the root cause of why we can't build this thing. In theory, it ought to always be possible to resolve these automatically, but in practice, to do so would require that we limit the shape that that dependency mesh can have. And, you know, with 1,100 people involved, it's just nice to have a way to manually go in and say, ah, yes, we've seen this before, and that's not going to work until this particular thing related to GNOME 2 gets built. Fail for source problem, that's the one that everybody hates. It's the sort of what the rest of the talk's about. So what really is the problem? Why is it that porting's such a problem? Well, fundamentally, it's because programmers are lazy. And in fact, I think programmers being lazy is wonderful. I'm really lazy as a programmer. You know, never write a line of code if you can swipe it from somewhere else. You know, I think all of you probably, that have, any of you that have ever written anything from a shell script or a Python thing or whatever, have probably, you know, always sort of looked around to see if there was something you could grab that was kind of close to write and hack on it instead of starting from scratch. Until, like Willie says every once in a while, this is just too disgusting, I've got to throw it out and do it again. But fundamentally, the problem is that programmers are lazy, and this shows up in a lot of different ways. One is that, you know, gosh darn it, not all modern processors are 32-bit. IA64 in particular, where I spent a lot of my time, is an LP64 architecture. Longs and pointers are 64 bits, but integers are still 32. So think about C. Think about all those things that happen when you, you know, naively pass pointers around and treat them as integers and do integer math on them. Well, it's kind of interesting to take a 64-bit pointer, treat it as an integer, you know, increment it, and then try to use it as a pointer again and discover that the other 32 bits disappeared. And unfortunately, some of these things, depending on the state of our compiler chain on any given day, some of those get detected and warned about very effectively at compile time, but somehow we're all sort of lazy and we're trained that, you know, warnings are just warnings, and just because it says that, you know, warning, you know, there's a problem in your size of your pointers and integers here that, since on our I386 systems it just happens to work anyway, it's really easy to ignore these things. But they cause real problems. A lot of times these are things that end up causing seg faults at runtime. And that's really nasty. They're hard to detect at build time. And certainly they need to be paid attention to when they're warned about at build time. Another thing, new architectures have to use new toolchain and library versions. There's just no way to get the attention of the people who work on compilers and libraries for adding something new unless you're willing to work with them in their development branch. You can't convince somebody that the thing that they took a deep sigh of relief and were pleased to sort of walk away from 6 months ago is the right place to go add support for your new architecture. Now, if they tried to add your new architecture before that release, maybe you can convince them that this is a bug they need to fix. But in most cases, you're asking them to add new functionality or support things that weren't there before, and nobody likes to do that in, quote, old code. So, in the Debian ports in particular, IA64 used GCC 296 for a long time, and HPPA never used anything successfully less than GCC 3.x for any length of time. Fortunately now, like within the last month, we've pulled the switch and all Debian architectures are using GCC 3.2 as their default. I gotta tell you though, that was a huge amount of work, and I suspect it won't be terribly long before some new architecture pops up and says, oh yeah, well, you know, they won't put support for us into the, you know, into the 3.2 tree. We're going to have to build using 3.71 or something, and life will get interesting again. Kernel versions. You know, Debian's been really good in I386 space about, you know, preferring stability over currency in kernel versions a lot of times in the past, but new architectures can almost never use old kernel versions. We were lucky that most of the architectures that, all of the architectures that were in the Woody release are ones that had been going concerns long enough that they could be part of a 2.4 kernel, a stable kernel release. But before we got to Woody, there were long periods of time where different architectures were running, you know, pretty scary kernels. I guess Dan Shearer commented earlier today that, you know, you're at a Linux conference when somebody loans you their laptop and asks you please to be careful because it's their stable production software development platform and they're running 2.5.50. but it's sort of a fact of life when you're working on leading edge stuff that you have to deal with leading edge versions. This is not very compatible with people who, you know, sort of think their toolchain problems are dealt with and they want to be off working on something else and they're happy with an older version on their other architectures. This whole business of position-independent code and what linkers do with it on different architectures has been a real hassle on Debian. In the end, we've basically just written policies that have said, you know, everything has to be compiled with the pick options. And this means that in some specific cases, on some architectures, there is a modest amount of performance degradation for certain performance-intensive libraries. And in those cases, people often come up with some creative way to, make the faster version available anyway. But what ends up happening here is that, we've got architectures, PowerPC is one of them, i64 is another, where you just can't do that. The linker doesn't support it. On i386, the linker does support it, but just because it works in some places doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And it's intriguing how often when you're trying to port user space applications, you run into really interesting sort of underlying assumptions that you go and you dig for all and you can't figure out why this thing, isn't compiling, and all of a sudden you realize it's because, oh, they assumed down in the bottom of this that, there's a VGA card out there. And they're doing something silly poking around in VGA space, and gee, this machine doesn't have a legacy video interface, and VGA's memory is not in the address range it was before. Or more specifically, it's a system with a serial console, or a system with no console, and you're using some remote management interface to fake a console on the system. Systems that don't have sound hardware. I remember the day the S390 guys in Debian sent a message to one of the list asking it was okay if they treated all of the packages that had audio requirements as not for us. This is a list that we've sort of tweaked on over time. If you've heard me talk about porting things, you may have seen an older version of this before. Lamont Jones is a Debian developer who's currently the guy running the PA RISC auto builder. Also a very good friend of mine, works at HP. Doesn't get paid to work on Linux. He just puts in gazillions of hours doing Debian stuff, in the margins. This is sort of his list of funny things that we've run into in the auto building environment trying to make the PA RISC stuff work. But I think it's a pretty good list. His favorite is the, but it works on my Pentium. It's so frustrating when you're dealing with a porting problem and you're this close to having it right, and you go to the developer, the maintainer of that package, you go to upstream and they go, well, works for me, what's your problem? And this is the flavor of it that's sort of the most frustrating. We have a huge number of cases where upstream software authors were using the GNU, AutoMake and or AutoConf stuff where the package ships with these two files called config-sub and config-guest that are used to determine what the current system is. Well, those files are actually sort of independent of the process. They provide data and sort of recognition logic to figure out what kind of system you're on, but people are really bad about ever updating them. As long as the machines they're building it on, they have versions that work, it's okay. But, I guess the most recent case was there was some change in related to the MIPS architecture. And all of a sudden, there are a bunch of packages that wouldn't build successfully on MIPS because they couldn't recognize that it was a MIPS Linux system. Somewhere else in here, there's down here where HPPA equals HPUX. It's one of the natures of this is that if somebody's done PA RISC support before, but at that time the only PA RISC operating system they knew of was HPUX, there may be a test coded in either. There used to be in the config sub, config guest stuff, and there still are in some package specific auto configuration things that said if it's PA RISC, it must be HPUX. And those things get frustrating. You just have to deal with them, find them, and fix them. I've already talked about the sizes of integers and pointers not being the same. GCC version 3, C++, namespace, syntax, various issues that had to be resolved. Almost every interesting C++ using package in Debian's gotten touched one or more times in order to get it over the GCC 3.x transition. Getting all architectures running 3.2 is a whole lot easier because the PA RISC folks had spent countless hours chasing those down and fixing them in order to be able to get enough packages built to release with Woody. A more recent problem now that we're over the GCC 3.2 transition is it's really frustrating to run into people who solve the this doesn't work on i64 because it's using GCC 296 problem by coding a dependency that says if it's not GCC 295, there's no point in trying to build it. Because, of course, today that's just broken. That's the wrong test to use. So, again, it was sort of a, I don't know if that one's entirely due to laziness, but it's a way of coding a dependency that turns out in the end to not have been a very long-lived way of coding a dependency. This whole business about signed versus unsigned chars and S390 trips over that a lot, is another similar case where, you know, people aren't being very specific about what they're specifying in the source code, and if they're making assumptions about chars either being signed or unsigned when it runs on a machine with the other case, strange things happen. And one of the ways we got around a lot of these things before the Woody release, and the reason we're actually able to release 11 architectures, is that for a relatively short period of time we adopted something called the Zero Tolerance for Reporting Problems policy, which basically said if the only bug in a source package was one of these config sub, config guess, or related silly little porting problems, and the maintainer of the package in Debian wasn't perceived as being particularly responsive, bam, we just upload a new version of it and let the maintainer catch up later. And that helped. So how can you help with all of this stuff? Well, first thing is implicit declarations are bad. You ever compiled something with GCC and seen these things about warning implicit declaration of such and such a variable? Implicit declaration means you're depending on the compiler's default behaviors for that object type. Sometimes that's okay, sometimes it's not. What's the default return type for a function in C? Pass pointers through the returns from values from functions recently? Think about it a little bit. Implicit declarations are bad. If you see those warnings, basically what I'm really asking for is please try to drive the total number of warnings from GCC to zero. There are some of them that are really hideously hard to get rid of. There are some of places where you may fundamentally disagree that that's a problem. That's okay. If you've consciously thought about it and made a decision, I'm a happy boy. But if, like 95% of the people in the world who use compilers, you look at it and you go, oh, it's just a warning, chances are when your code hits Debian, it's going to have a problem and we're going to end up having to file a bug on it and hunt you down and kill you. I can't say this enough times. If you care about porting issues, then run on some second architecture. And you don't have to, like, go buy hardware to do this. There are all sorts of really great ways. I mean, if you happen to be a Debian developer, there are a few of you in the audience, aren't there? Debian developers? See, and they even admit it. Debian developers have access to a pool of machines that includes one example of almost all of the released architectures that they can go get shell access on to try things. But there are other places. HP now has this testdrive.hp.com thing, which is derived from a similar program that was being run by Compaq before the merger. And anyone who wants to can go to testdrive.hp.com, fill out a silly little form to request an account, and have shell access on each of a dozen or more combinations. It's Alpha and TA-RISC and IA64 and IA32 systems running most of the combinations of operating systems that are interesting on those platforms. And yes, Debian is included. There are Debian systems for all four architectures at this point, I believe, that you can get shell access on and go try things. And by the way, that's a pretty good cross-section. You've got, you know, both Endians and you've got 32 and 64-bit machines. Probably the majority of the things you'd run into as a porter you could trip over there. Test builds in a minimal fruit environment. In Debian, there's this wonderful tool written by Junichi Yuokawa called PBuilder. It doesn't scale well for being like an auto builder, even though he uses it to rebuild the entire archive over and over to help identify source problems that are caused by tool chain updates and things like that. But for individual users, it's really awesome. It allows you an easy way to create a Debian minimal truted build environment, try building packages there, update it as you need to, and so forth. You can log into the Taroot and poke around manually, or you can just tell it to go try and build this package and give me the log from it, and so forth. It's really easy to use. You have to have super user privs on the machine you're putting it on, so, you know, do it on your laptop or something. But this also allows you to do things like try a build on unstable when you're running stable, or the more normal case, try to build something for stable when you're running unstable. How not to help? Please, please, please don't say, gee, all I have is a Pentium, why should I care about anything else? That's a really frustrating attitude to deal with. And frankly, I think in the long term, it's not the right answer, because while it's absolutely true that in excess of 95% of all of the hits on Debian's mirror network for packages files, which is sort of the best way to figure out who cares about which architecture? More than 95% of those are for i386. I honestly believe that by fixing all of these things that we stumble over as porting problems, we're not just making it possible for software to run successfully across more architectures or more kernels or whatever, but we're reducing the probability that we'll be caught unawares someday when some tool chain or library guru changes some default behavior or some standards group, you know, imposes some clarification of their language standard that everybody runs off to implement. The same kinds of things that fix porting problems today will help keep us from being caught by surprise and all of a sudden having software work differently just because we recompiled it on a new tool chain. It all really comes down to doing a good job of completely specifying the characteristics of the data objects that you're working with or the behaviors that you expect. And I really, you know, I think that's worth doing because in the end it makes all of this code better code. If you're interested in this stuff, as I mentioned, testdrive.hp.com is out there. I have nothing to do with it other than answering admin questions for them when they have trouble with the Debian boxes. I mentioned build.debian.org earlier. There is, of course, the whole sort of www.debian.org website. If you don't know about Debian and want to learn, but this particular site's the one I talked about. And all of the talks that I've done for the last 3 years or so are available on my website if you want to go back and pull some of this to log other people with and help us out. That's pretty much all I had today. Now I'd be pleased to take questions for a few.